we've been looking at the entire process of selecting. We've talked to a lot of people about the analytics and metrics we use. We're in the process of trying to see if we can generate something new. But I thought the quadrant system certainly gave people outside the room a better picture. I thought it was a better sorting tool. It was really recommended by the national basketball coaches. We feel it gives the public a much better picture of the discussion that goes on in the room. But we're trying to look at how did people do against tournament caliber teams. Who did they play? Where did they play them? How did they do? Oklahoma got in because they played 30-some basketball games. We count each game the same, and they certainly didn't play well down the stretch, but they had an outstanding early part of the season. We look at a game in November to be just as important as we do a game in February and March. They slumped down the stretch. It affected their seeding, but they had enough quality wins in their overall schedule to justify being in the field.
Quadrant 1 just favors all the elite conferences. Think about the opportunities they get. I know I could feel for those little guys going 28-5 and 25-6 sitting home. And I just think it's sad in a way that mediocrity rather than common sense sometimes. You look at numbers, numbers, numbers. There's something called common sense.
If you play in a conference that doesn't give you anything and you want to get in as an at-large, you'd better play somebody in the non-conference. That's the responsibility that you have in a lesser conference. Look, if they look at this and somebody says, well, I think this team is better, I'm not going to argue with them. That's fine. But they're contradicting themselves left and right, and committees should not be sending messages when their charge is to put the best teams in. This is the national championship event. If they're trying to send messages, then they should find another business. That's not what they should be up to.
Trey Young is fun to watch. We hyped him as much as anyone. He's dynamic. He's must-see TV. But that team was not a good basketball team.
I don't want to say it's by design because I don't want to be that cynical, but they've thrown so many disparate criteria together that you could almost justify any team that you want. And I'll be candid. Given the upsets that happened in the quote-unquote one-bid leagues, I understand. I think they, frankly, should have been left out. But if I wanted to get indignant, I could say, you mean to tell me for the first time in history you're going to leave a team out with an RPI that's in the top 40? That's unheard of. You've never done that before. And I would be right. And you could say, and the RPI was obviously more of a factor this year than you said it was going to be. So you pick and choose which stats you want to make relevant, and I think that's what makes it confusing.
They can do whatever they want now because they've got the veteran quarterback insurance that they needed. They get Tyrod Taylor from the Buffalo Bills. And again, if they want to go Sam Darnold at number one, Josh Allen at number one, they now have a quarterback so that they can play him and not have to rush a rookie along in Cleveland. They can bring him along slowly, and they can bring him along as Tyrod Taylor is throwing to Jarvis Landry, who the Cleveland Browns surrendered two picks for today.
I think it actually solidifies the fact that they will stick with a quarterback. Not probably. I think that they have to. They haven't addressed the position from a position of strength since they came back in 1999 when they took Tim Couch. That's the last time they actually took a quarterback top 10. Now they have the opportunity to decide which one they want. Take him first, and he can then wait for a year behind Tyrod Taylor, who's on a one-year contract, and then presumably take over in 2019.
John Dorsey, their new general manager, who's got together, you know, let's face it, some significant personnel staff together, that he has been plotting and planning for some time. These things just don't happen with a snap of the finger. I have no doubt that Tyrod Taylor was kind of a target for him.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Welcome indeed to the extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket, where we are, Toledo's sports leader. Oh my, oh my. What a weekend of activity. We got conference championships decided. We got automatic bids decided. We got the full bracketology field settled upon. We've got all kinds of snubs to discuss. We got all kinds of misseedings to discuss. We've got a tournament to predict. We've got trade after trade after trade, mating by the new high-stakes riverboat gambler John Dorsey out there running the show in Cleveland, where the Clowns are still foundering with a 1-31 record over the last 2 years and an embarrassing, I don't know, 4-48 or something stupid over the last 4 or 5 years. Now they've got all kinds of new players. Now they got all kinds of new positioning as they head into free agency and, of course, the NFL draft, in which they hold, I think, 5 out of the first 64 picks in the draft. We've got Tiger Woods returning to the PGA Tour in a way that he has not been in several years, finishing one stroke out of the win for what would have been his 80th Tour Championship. Just one stroke, one putt. Come on, Tiger. One putt somewhere in the middle of the round between 1 and 17. And we have a playoff going to the playoff with Paul Casey, who ended up winning the Valspar Championship. And nobody cared. Nobody cared about poor Paul Casey winning the Valspar because Tiger Woods was indeed back on his game. And now with 3 weeks before the Masters, everybody is talking about whether Tiger will win his fifth green jacket. So we've got that to talk about today as well. So many different places to go. We got great guests to join us in those discussions. Coming up at 3:35, in about 20 minutes from now or so, Chris Daubertin will join us, SB Nation's college basketball bracketologist. How will he size up the field? Which is the toughest region, which is the easiest region in the field, and who will be the Final Four? We'll talk to Chris Daubertin about that. We'll take your thoughts, too, if you'd like to offer them, at 866-240-1065. Was Michigan overseeded? Was Michigan State underseeded? Was Ohio State properly seeded? And which teams should have been seeded and are not at all because they have been left out of the tournament? Obviously, the Rockets' magical run through the MAC championship game came to an end as Buffalo took the Rockets down for the second time this season. They were the best team, Buffalo was, in the MAC all season long. They did win the conference tournament relatively comfortably, winning some you know.
It helps for Buffalo
days.
When the MAC Player of the Year ain't there.
Well, you know what, MAC Player of the Year Trayshawn was not there. Also in the semifinal against
right.
Eastern Michigan, and somehow, by the way, massive credit
yes
to Coach Todd Kowalczyk and the rest of the Rockets, by the way, for playing without him and his was it a knee injury, I guess. Kept him out of the semifinal game against Eastern Michigan. They somehow managed to beat the team, Kush, that beat them twice in the final, week and a half or so of the regular season. Eastern Michigan did, and then they met them, of course, in that tournament semis. And the Rockets, somehow, some way, without the conference player of the year, managed to pull off that victory, advancing to the final against Buffalo, where they just could not get one more. So
yeah, they couldn't, and it was a bummer, obviously, for that. There's definitely someone else. We'll hear from Coach, I believe, tomorrow on the wrap up of all that. But just a bummer way for the Rockets to end. You hate to see it that way. I mean, they haven't made a tournament since '80, and then to lose the best player. They actually first lost him at the very end of the quarterfinal game, literal last minutes, where he first right. dinged that knee and then didn't play in the next two. And yeah, kudos to the Rockets that were still there, especially in that Eastern Michigan game for stepping up.
And yeah, and how about it with Marion Jackson with the game-winning three, a career-high 8-3, school record 8-3s,
yes.
career-high 26 points for Marion Jackson in Trayshawn Fletcher's absence in that game. But the season does come to an end for the Rockets, and that's really unfortunate. When does the NIT announcements, when are they made, Jim? Because, and I know we talked about this going into the conference tournament, that it looked like if the Rockets did not win the tournament and go to the NCAAs,
right.
that they will likely not get an NIT bid either.
No, yeah, they wait until about 8:30 or so, I believe, is when that bracket came out last night. And, yeah, the Rockets were unfortunately not there.
Oh, I didn't even look at it. I'm sorry. So it did come out last night.
Yeah, the last couple of years they've been
tonight.
Doing the NIT bracket at about like 8:30 or 9 o'clock
yeah.
or something. I peeked in because I wanted to see if they would get in. I didn't think they would. We talked about that last week, and they kind of they didn't. And it's a bummer for the MAC, because between the NCAA and the NIT,
it's
there's only one MAC team, and usually there's been at least two
yeah.
in both tournaments. This year there's only one, and it's Buffalo.
Yeah, and that's just garbage. It really, really is. It's a smack in the face to some of the smaller schools, as was, by the way, Jay Billis, not my favorite dude when it comes to college basketball. Smacking small and mid-conference, mid-major conference teams in the face today as he was on TV griping about how you can't call this a national basketball championship tournament because the best teams in college basketball are not in it. He said some of the best teams are, and then he took a smack at mid-major and small conference teams and their, quote, automatic bids because of their conference tournaments. You know, these teams who have no chance of winning a national championship, he said. You know, he said the tournament is idiot-proof, meaning despite all of the incorrect things that they do in this in terms of having the mid-majors and the smaller conferences getting automatic bids.
Right.
And the misseedings and the teams that are snubbed, et cetera. He said it's still going to be great, exciting theater. He said, but you can't call it a true national championship tournament without having the best teams in the nation in it. And many of the best teams are not in it because of the small schools' automatic bids.
Yep.
So Billis and others continue to play that elitist game over, you know, the small conferences, you know, preferring to gripe about what 19 and 14 team from a major conference with a sub-500 record in their conference didn't get in, you know, and Buffalo did. They didn't name Buffalo by name, but you understand the point.
Yes, yes.
And, of course, a second MAC team getting in even into the NIT is just, you know, that's not allowed. It's just, it's crap is what it is.
I mean, and there's also
Division I or they're not Division I. If they're Division I and they have a record like that and they get an opportunity, they ought to be given the opportunity if they earn it to play.
Yeah, no doubt. This is part of the reason that I threw out that one suggestion. I remember one of the discussions we had last week, Bob, suggesting how the smaller conferences like the MACs and others should realign their conference tournaments since everybody does these things, and that's where the technical bid comes from if you're not going to eliminate them altogether. So we did kind of go over some of that. You know what? They're talking a lot about numbers and RPIs and different rankings and how the committee sends messages and yada, yada, yada. Through all of that, I did some research last night. I got a new theory as to part of the reason you don't see the mid-majors in there, why your St. Mary's and Middle Tennessee's also got snubbed. Part of this is, you know, we talked a lot about it in the last bunch of years from the football angle, because that's, of course, what drives it, right? But we're really seeing the effects of all that football-driven realignment having finally trickled down to the basketball side of things. 2014 was the big mark. You know, that's when the old Big East stopped and the new Big East, and you have the American Athletic. I personally, for my rankings of the conferences, I promoted the Atlantic 10. And if you do that, there's 8 power conferences, and everybody else is essentially a one bid with maybe a few asterisks, like when the West Coast gets multiple. That's the Gonzaga factor.
Right.
Things like that. In other words, what I'm saying is, and you can look this up, in the years prior, so 2013, 12, 11, and beyond, there's 3 to 5 different non-power leagues that are sending multiple teams to the tournament. The trickle-down effect of all that football-driven realignment is there's 8 power conferences, and essentially everybody else is one bid. And that's how it's played out. Mountain West gets 2 this year, but that's only because of the bid thief because Nevada blew it. In 2017, the West Coast got 2. That was Gonzaga and St. Mary's. Mm-hmm. 2016, Missouri Valley got 2, but that's because Wichita State, now in a power conference, they blew their conference tournament. That's my argument. Another theory just to throw out there is maybe the fallout of conference realignment has a lot to do with this,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that's probably true. That's probably true. A really good analysis, especially when as you pointed out, it started out because of football, and obviously there are repercussions here in basketball as well. So we'll talk more about that, obviously, with Chris Daubertine coming up, about the brackets and about, the mid-majors and that argument. But just a great season. I want to cap that by saying great season for the Rockets and Treshawn Fletcher especially. Such a shame to see he did not get to play in those final 2 games of the tournament. And I wonder. I just have to wonder. You know, they lost by 10 to Buffalo. Would Treshawn's presence have changed that? Was he worth 10 points? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. We can't speculate. But, boy, it sure would have been fun to see him get an opportunity to play there and to see the Rockets continue on into this tournament. By the way, Buffalo, of course, makes the field as a 13 seed and obviously a long shot, as we will discuss coming up with Chris Daubertine. So Daubertine on the NCAAs, that'll be at 3:35. Then coming up at about 4:10, We're going to talk about what you also heard in the montage there. A lot of reactions to what the Cleveland Browns did over the weekend. Just a flurry of trades, and of course, none of which can be finalized until the league year starts, which is on, what, Wednesday, is it not, Jim?
Yeah, I believe Wednesday, yeah.
The league calendar year starts on Wednesday. That's when deals, trades can become finalized. And, of course, this tampering period starts now as teams can start flirting with free agents and start talking about dollars they would like to give them. They can't sign anything, of course, either until the league starts, the league year starts. But, boy, the Browns were busy. DeShone Kizer, Toledo's Central Catholic alum, Notre Dame alum, 1 year is the extent of his Browns career, and it is to his great benefit, in my opinion, that he escapes a situation that I've always described. Cleveland is where quarterbacks' careers go to die. That's just the way that it is. It was unfortunate that DeShone Kizer had to be drafted by the Browns. We were excited when it happened, right, Kush? I mean, you know, it's one of the two teams
we would love
to see a Toledo could go, either to Detroit or Cleveland. We can watch him close by, all that sort of thing. But he wandered into the worst place in the NFL for quarterbacks to go since 1999. Quite frankly, probably since 1993. Literally 25 years since the Browns had a competent quarterback. And that would have been Bernie Kosar before his skills so famously or infamously diminished in the eyes of Bill Belichick. He was right, by the way. But they have not had a quarterback since then that could play the position. And if they did, they didn't have the right circumstances for the kid or for the player to play the position. And I think that probably best describes DeShone Kizer. Kizer now moves on to continue his professional career in a much better place. He goes to Green Bay, where he will be the backup, I believe. No disrespect to Brett Hundley, but I believe he will be the backup to Aaron Rodgers. And, yes, the heir apparent to Aaron Rodgers. You know, Aaron Rodgers is such a great story for DeShone Kizer to read. Because Aaron Rodgers, as we all know, famously slid down, in his NFL draft, in the NFL draft.
Yep.
All the way to, what number did he end up finally being taken? 26?
Jeez, you know, I don't actually remember the exact number now that you're making me think about it.
You know, he was one of these green room guys where everybody said is going to be a high pick, and then he just slid, and then eventually ended up being taken by the Packers to be the heir apparent to Brett Favre. And we know how that went over the first three to four seasons of his career. Brett Favre continued to say, yeah, this is my last year, I'm done, and everybody's, all right, time for Aaron Rodgers to get ready, and then Favre would come back at the last minute, and then the next year in the offseason, I'm done, or I'm not sure if I'm done, I'm probably done, but I'm not sure if I'm done, all right, should we prepare Aaron Rodgers as the starter or not? I don't know, okay, I'm coming back. Rodgers had to sit again. Aaron Rodgers had to sit and watch Brett Favre's last three or four years, it would seem, of constant comebacks or non-comebacks, before he finally was able to put down the clipboard and the baseball cap and pick up his helmet. And while all of that probably was really, really difficult for Aaron Rodgers to digest, he was better for it in the long run because he was able to learn the game from a Hall of Famer like Brett Favre, even though Favre didn't exactly mentor him because that wasn't his way. But he was able to learn the game without the pressure of being what DeShone Kizer had to be, of being what Mitch Trubisky in Chicago this year had to be, of being what Jared Goff had to be, and then, of course, he got benched last year before coming out this year, of being what all of the top five pick kind of guys had to be, and that is a rookie starter who can win. And it's hard to do because generally if you're being picked in the top five, your team sucked. And when you get there, it's hard to win with a sucky roster around you, especially as you learn the game. I don't think DeShone Kizer would have been very well served learning the game in Cleveland again. I don't think he would have been very well served backing up Tyrod Taylor after Taylor was acquired in one of the moves that cost the Browns a third-round draft pick to get him from Buffalo. I don't think he would have been very well served being rushed back into duty. I don't think he would have been very well served being the third string guy, maybe behind Taylor and whatever quarterback they draft, first overall, probably. I just think DeShone Kizer's career took a major step forward, even though he will not play in 2018. unless Aaron Rodgers goes down again, which he has been known to do from time to time. When Aaron Rodgers is done, even if it takes 3 or 4 years, learning the game the way you will from a Rodgers will benefit Deshaun Kizer, I think, in the long run. His career will be fine. He will pick up and take over for Aaron Rodgers when that time is right. He'll still be a young guy, and he'll have an opportunity to play, you know, a lot of football in a much more stable organization with the Packers than he would have had, even if he would have, you know, liked to have been back on the field again this coming season. I think that would have been negative for him in an environment like Cleveland. So Central Catholics owned Deshaun Kizer finds himself in a better place, even though he will not be stepping on the field, presumably at all, in 2018 or for the next few years of the Aaron Rodgers career, Jim.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And yeah, I'm glad you're bringing up the whole Deshaun Kizer angle, you know, to all this, because once all the trades, and for those who lost count, there were four of them over like, what, a 2-day span over the weekend. The two thoughts that popped into my head, I'll start with my Deshaun Kizer thought, which is, you know, good for him. Going to Green Bay, into that system, that organization, and being behind Aaron Rodgers, good for you. That's about as good a situation you could get yourself into after the disaster that was playing for the Browns last year. And I hope things go better for him, you know, in his career. So that's my Kizer thought in it. And honestly, Bob, my other thought on the trades in general, and obviously there's still a lot to be seen, but just by what came in and what went out in these four trades, I don't know about you, but the first word that popped into my head over the weekend while thinking about these was competency. It feels like these are actual competent football moves. And I like that because we haven't seen that out of a Browns front office in I don't know how long.
Yeah, I'll give it competency, but I'll stop there. Listening to some Browns fans respond and react to those moves, they're already printing playoff tickets. Hashtag worst to first has been included in many, many a Browns tweet.
Stop
in the last
jumping the shark, guys. Just be
hours.
Happy with 5 wins, please.
Yeah, well, that would be jumping the gun, not jumping the shark. That's a different.
Oh, my bad. I got the metaphors wrong, didn't I?
But, you know, I mean, look, at the end of the day, are they better now? Yes. Do we need to pump the brakes a little? Yes. The Bills couldn't get rid of Tyrod Taylor and or his salary fast enough. There's a reason for that. Can he win in the NFL? Has he proven that he can? Yes. Does that mean that this team is now suddenly a contender? No. Jarvis Landry from Miami is a very good wide receiver. Is he Antonio Brown? No. But is he a really good dynamic guy who can get the ball in the end zone? Yeah. When he's got good quarterbacks throwing to him, if you put him in a situation where he's catching the ball from Drew Brees, he's an all-pro. If you put him in a situation where he's going to be catching the ball from Tyrod Taylor, his effectiveness is minimized. That's just a fact. I'm not trying to bag on Tyrod. He's an improvement over what the Browns have had in recent years and an improvement over Deshaun's rookie year because Deshaun was a rookie. And Tyrod has played the game and can win at this level. He can't be a playoff quarterback in this level, not much of one anyway. But you will not maximize an elite NFL receiver with Tyrod as your quarterback. He's the proverbial bridge to whomever the Browns select at number one overall. Make no mistake about that. And the cornerback, Randall, is what? He's a corner.
The biggest thing on him I already heard is that he's probably in the Browns system going to play more free safety
exactly.
than corner. That to me is the biggest notation there.
Right. So he's not, you know, they need improvement at corner. And, you know, maybe if he plays free safety, that allows Jabril Peppers, the Michigan grad, to play strong safety, which he's probably much better suited for. So it's a piece, but at the end of the day, you got a quarterback that his current team was trying to get rid of for a reason. You got a corner who's not really a corner, is going to be a safety, which doesn't really necessarily get me too terribly excited. And you got a receiver who certainly will be the best receiver on the Browns, no question about it. Let's not expect the numbers he put up in his previous 2 or 3 years to come back and exist in this situation with Tyrod Taylor and a very, very different type of offense that he'll be a part of. Todd Haley, of course, is the new coordinator. We don't know what kind of offense he will put together, but just from a skills standpoint, understand that the Browns quarterback of the future is still not on the roster. Tyrod Taylor is a placeholder, so let's not get too terribly excited about the placeholder. And oh, by the way, I am happy that the placeholder is Tyrod Taylor over A.J. McCarron.
Agreed.
I would rather have Taylor. I think Taylor is much better than McCarron. I'm just, you know, like I said, let's pump the brakes here before getting too terribly excited.
Well, if I can, just real quick, I agree with that. I would rather have a Tyrod Taylor, you know, over an A.J. McCarron in that kind of veteran placeholder scenario. Though, if you remember, Bob, I was the one who said, because where did Tyrod Taylor play his college ball? Virginia Tech. I'm still surprised to this day that he's lasted in the NFL as long as he has. Just take that for what it's worth.
Fair enough. And I don't know that I would be that surprised. I'm surprised that he's still a starter or in a position now with the Browns to be the starter again. He was a starter in Buffalo. But that surprised me, but not that he's in the NFL. He's good enough to be a backup. I've seen a lot of crap in the NFL in the backup and in the third quarterback situation. I'm not surprised he's still in the NFL, in my opinion. I know you watched him more closely in college than I did, but just what I do know about him, which is less than you, it doesn't surprise me he's still there. But he's not long for being a starter in this league. All right, it's 3:33, so we got to do. We're going to talk some bracketology with Chris Daubertin of SB Nation coming up as we kind of handicap the field that has been laid out by the NCAA Selection Committee. We can't do any of that, however, until we get wild.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents The Wild Stat of the Day, brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports.
I'm about to read you a paragraph of wild stats. I could replace this, by the way, with just one sentence for your wild stat. And that one sentence would be, Tiger Woods finished second at Valspar. That's your wild stat. No, because nobody thought he was going to do that.
That's
nobody
true.
Nobody thought it. Strange thing is, his final round, he only had birdies on 1 and 17. Bogey free the rest of the way, and just pars the rest of the way. Shot a 70, just one stroke short of winning it, and that is wild enough as we are 3 weeks away from the Masters. But since Jim Kushner went to the trouble of putting together this paragraph of wild stats relating to the NCAA tournament, let's lay it out. This is kind of a wild stat and public service announcement combined as you fill out your brackets over the next 2 or 3 days. One thing we would like to try and get right are the upsets that are going to take place during this tournament, this first weekend, the real madness. And the problem is picking the right upsets. With that in mind, here are the all-time seed matchup records for the first round games in the tournament since it expanded to the current size in 1985. First up, we know that number one seeds are still undefeated against the 16s, 132-0. Second round, the ones are 114-17 all-time against the 8-9 winner. When we get to the two seeds, they're 124-8 against the 15s. Three seeds beat the 14s 111-21. Four seeds are 106-26 all-time against the 13s. Then when you get to the main upset potentials, it starts with the famed 12-5, although the 12s still lead the series 85-47. Sixes beat 11s at a nearly identical number at 83-49 against the 11s. And in the 7-10 matchups, the 7s, 81-51 over the 10s. While the toss-up games are, of course, the 8-9 matchups, the 8s lead 67-65, just about as close as you would expect 8 versus 9 to be. So keep those in mind if and when you are picking your upsets in the brackets coming up between now and the start of the tournament on Thursday. And that's right, I said it, I'll say it again, the tournament starts Thursday, not with the first four. Those are play-in games, not tournament games. Let's get at the bottom of the hour local sports center and come back and talk bracketology with Chris Daubertin next.
A Bob France extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. 3:44 rolling onward on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo Sports Leader. Coming up at about 4:10, we're going to talk to Scott Petrak about all of those crazy Browns moves. You just heard Jim Kushlin detail in the sports center. But for now, let's talk brackets. Our favorite bracketologist this particular NCAA tournament season and conference championship tournament season has been Chris Daubertin. He's been with us on this show. He's been with Kushlin on Drive Time. And he's back now that we actually have brackets to look at. It's going to be more fun. Chris Daubertin of SB Nation right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Hey, Chris, thanks for the time. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
So now it's not about guessing who's going to be in the tournament. We know who's going to be in the tournament. It's about picking apart the committee selections and telling everybody what they got right and what they got wrong. Let's start there. Before we start predicting matchups and Final Fours, which we would like you to do before we finish up at the top of the hour, we'll ask for your pick in each region. But, you know, a lot of people are screaming about snubs, and they're talking about Middle Tennessee, and they're talking about Oklahoma State instead of Oklahoma, or technically. They're complaining that Oklahoma made it instead of Oklahoma State. And there are a host of others. Can you give me your overall impression? And if you want to identify a few teams that are just, you know, it's an outrage that they're not in this tournament, you can go ahead and do that too.
Well, I spent a lot of Sunday kind of thinking about, you know, how many teams I was going to get wrong. And, you know, because they threw in all these new wrinkles this year about, you know, adding extra metrics and changing the way quality wins were organized. But when it came down to it, we didn't learn anything new. There, nothing really changed with the brackets. So I was really glad that I ended up changing my mind from keeping Middle Tennessee and St. Mary's in the field on Friday to pulling them out and putting some combination of Syracuse, Arizona State, USC in there. I should have left USC in and taken USC out and put Arizona State back in. I would have gotten them all right. That was my one miss. But really the thing is, you know, I talked about Middle Tennessee having a couple of, you know, good quality wins by numbers against Murray State and Western Kentucky, especially compared to a team like Louisville who had RPI wins that were against better known teams that weren't ranked as high. And kind of looking at that, looking how Arizona got in and how Syracuse got in based on the wins that they picked up, it became very clear to me that when they're talking quality wins, they mean more name brand wins. Arizona State beat Xavier in Kansas. Syracuse beat, you know, Louisville, Miami, and Clemson late. You know, all teams that were kind of, Miami and Clemson in particular, in the top 20. Also, quality wins matter. Your losses don't matter so much, at least in terms of selection. It does matter in terms of your seeding. You know, if Syracuse doesn't lose to Georgia Tech and Wake Forest on the road, they're probably not playing in Dayton on Wednesday. You know, Oklahoma, all those losses, they're probably a little bit higher seed, and they don't pick those up. But all those wins, same with Arizona State, those wins are what got them in. The losses are what ended up punishing them on the seed line. And that's really pretty consistent for how the committee has acted over the past, really, 5 years at least.
We are talking with Chris D'Abertine of SB Nation. He is their resident bracketologist. Jim Cushlin is here as well as part of this conversation. Jimmy?
And you know what? I brought this up with Bob, Chris, last segment to start with. You know, there's a lot of the metrics things. And by the way, I'm not as big a fan of the quadrant system as some are, like the committee chair who we had in the montage for some of his audio from last night. On the grounds that, if you remember, the whole problem was, well, the RPI is kind of antiquated. Well, the quadrant system is completely based on the RPI, so nothing changes. Yeah. I'm going to offer one other possible explanation that I haven't heard anybody else bring up. And, Bob, you remember I said this in the first segment. I think what we're viewing, because this is like the third or fourth straight year that we've had essentially every single at-large coming from a power conference, maybe one or two other schools maximum getting an at-large, and then everybody else gets one bid. I submit to you that another possible reason, it's not the sole reason, but it certainly is part of it, is we're finally in the true fallout and the trickle-down effect of the football-driven realignment. You know, for example, Missouri Valley is blatantly a one-bid league again because there's no Wichita State at the tip-top of it. Mm-hmm. The West Coast, they every now and then get multiple bids, but I would submit to you that's the Gonzaga factor. How much do you think the fallout of the realignment, because here's a perfect example, before the realignment really took effect, and I'm putting 2014, by the way, guys, as the benchmark year, because that's when the old Big East ceased, the American Athletic got created. In 2012, check this out, guys, the Mountain West sent 4, the Atlantic 10 sent 4, West Coast sent 3, Metro Atlantic even, it was a multi-bid league, along with Missouri Valley Conference USA. The last 3 years, Mountain West got 2 this year, and you could argue that's a bid thief because Nevada blew it. 2017 was West Coast had 2. That's your Gonzaga factor. And 2016, the only non-powers conference to have multiple bids. Missouri Valley, that was the Wichita State factor. Not many people have been bringing this up. How much do you think, Chris, that the fallout from all that football-driven realignment is part of the reason that this is affecting it? Because there's a clear tier system. You're basically, nowadays, you're either a power conference or you're a one-bid league. There's really no wiggle room anymore.
Absolutely. I mean, I was looking at this over the weekend, and I wrote about this as to why I end up bumping St. Mary's and Middle Tennessee out. 2012-2013, the mid-major conferences had a combined 21 at-large bids. 2015, that number drops to 6. 2016 and 2017 combined is 6. And at that point, that's where we're talking about. All the top of the A-10, all those teams moved into the Big East primarily.
Are you counting the Atlantic 10, by the way, as a mid-major or a power?
Yeah, I'm counting the A-10 as a mid-major.
Okay, because I actually personally, as a fallout, just me personally, I have promoted them to major conference status since the realignment. So that's the only quibble conference, by the way. Just want to make sure that was that.
Yeah, that's right. But another interesting factor here to keep in mind when thinking about the last four and first four out, especially 2015 and 2016, your eight NIT number one seeds in those seasons, six of them were from outside of the power conferences. Granted, you know, two of those were from the A-10. So even still, that's half if you take the A-10 out of the equation, four of the eight. So those teams are getting passed over and just not making the cut. And, you know, we've had NIT one seeds, you know, still 2017 and 2018 coming out of those non-power conferences as well. So that really does seem to be the divide at this point.
Chris Daubertine joining us as we talk about the brackets that came out yesterday. Let me ask you a question about something they were talking about on ESPN television this morning, Chris, and I'm just curious as to your thoughts as it pertains to the seed line. And I know you've already spoken on it a little bit. It seems as though a number of the schools that were included in the FBI report of a week ago, that there are investigations about, you know, some malfeasance being committed or other by each of those schools, they were all negatively impacted on the seed line, perhaps more than they might have been based solely on their seasons and their RPI, or not RPIs, but all of the other metrics that are used now going into these things. For example, Arizona is thought by many to be one of the top, you know, maybe two or three teams in the tournament, and you know they come down with a three seed, and some are saying that's a little bit unfair. Same thing with a few of the other ones. Did you notice that, and do you think that it's right for the committee a four seed Arizona, I beg your pardon. Michigan State also, even though it was minor what they were accused of, and according to Coach Izzo, everything has been resolved and rectified, you know, them coming down with a three seed is a little bit too low, perhaps. Many think they're one of the top three or four teams in the country as well. Do you think that report of FBI, the FBI investigations against those programs impacted even Louisville not making it, the way that they were suggesting this morning on ESPN?
Possibly. I think it's probably a stronger case to be made in the case of Louisville and Arizona. You know, Louisville, I think, really, their lack of, you know, real top-quality wins is what cost them, you know, especially when you compare their resumes to Syracuse. Arizona, I had Arizona as my second three seed. So they ended up being a full six spots lower, you know, on the committee seed list, seven spots lower, because they got six spots lower from 10 to 16. Michigan State, not so much, because Michigan State, because their non-conference schedule wasn't as good as it normally is, and, of course, the Big Ten not being as strong this year, you know, a three seed to me was fair. Actually, they ended up a little bit higher than I had them. I had them as the last three seed. The committee had them as the first three seed. So, you know, a little bit of a quibble there, but nothing big. But to me, Arizona was really the one that kind of jumped out at me. And I'm not sure, you know, because usually it's not something that's official. But if a team wins both its conference regular season and tournament championship, they usually get a little bit of a seeding bump. So I'm wondering if they didn't win that game in Vegas on Saturday night over USC, would they have been a five seed? You know, I don't know if it really has to do with the investigation, but it does seem a little bit odd to me nonetheless.
Let me ask you about a couple of teams. You mentioned the Big Ten being down. Purdue comes out with the highest seed in the Big Ten as a two seed. Michigan with a three, as well as Michigan State. And then Ohio State checks in with a five. Any quibbles or qualms about how any of those teams were seeded or where?
Nope. I had every single one of those exactly right. I had Purdue as a two, Michigan State. Oh, I had Michigan ahead of Michigan State, and then Ohio State as the number one, as the last five seed, actually.
Give me your thoughts on the Buckeyes as the last five seed, as you're talking about. Did your opinion of them, and what is your opinion, I guess, of them? I was going to ask if it changed going into this tournament based on their early flame out in the Big Ten Conference tournament and their mediocre finish at the end of the season. Are they kind of just trending downward? Do you anticipate an earlier exit for them, or do they have a decent shot of getting to 16?
I think they're going to have a real hard time getting out of the first weekend. I think that the South Dakota State matchup is very difficult. Well, I think they'll get through it, though. Mm-hmm. But that second matchup against the Gonzaga team they already lost to pretty handily back in Portland in November, you know, and that's a team that, you know, it's not as good as it was last year, but they've seen him firsthand, and the way the Buckeyes have struggled lately, I think that that's really kind of a danger sign for them to kind of have that matchup again.
What about the Wolverines with Montana and then presumably Houston? That's who I picked, at least, when I put my early bracket together here. In pencil, I reserve the right to erase anything until Thursday, and I will based on suggestions from people like you who study this a lot more closely than I do. But Houston is a very good basketball team as well. What do you think the Wolverines have in store?
I think Michigan can do better than they did last year. Last year, I thought they were going to at least get the Sweet 16. I think this team, with that draw, has at least Elite Eight potential. I think they can maybe even surprise North Carolina. And from then on, we'll see.
Not to say I would pick Texas A&M over North Carolina, but I feel like that might be kind of a bit of a sleeper team. I'm not going to pick them on my penciled in bracket right now, but I think that could be a very good basketball game. Do you not?
It could be a very good basketball game. The thing with A&M is they're just so inconsistent. As somebody who, you know, follows the SEC pretty closely, they're one of those teams that I think they'll get by Providence. I think the Providence isn't going to score enough to really keep up with them. But Texas A&M is just one of those squads that has a really hard time putting together two good games in a row. And I think with the short turnaround time especially, that's going to be a little bit difficult for them to get past UNC in the second round.
As long as we're talking about Texas team, another one that I like a lot is Texas Tech. And I don't know if it's fair to call a three seed a sleeper, is it? I mean, that's if you're seeded third, you're thought of as, you know, one of the 12 best teams in the country going into the tournament just simply by the number. So maybe that's not much of a sleeper. But I like them, and they could very well, you know, make a bit of a run until they run into Villanova, who I think will come out of that region.
Yeah, they're the third best team in KenPom in defensive efficiency, the number one team in the Big 12. They're Florida's potential second-round matchup, so that's what I'm not really looking forward to, because that's the type of team that can really clamp down on an inconsistent squad like Florida. So, yeah, so I think that them going to the 16s is probably a minimum for them.
We're talking with Chris D'Albertine, SB Nation bracketologist. Jim Cushelin is with us as well. Jim, go ahead.
Now a question for you on not necessarily the local teams, but some of the upset possibilities. Honestly, and like Bob...
Well, you know what, Jim? If we could then, if you're going in that direction, let me just get the other local team.
Go. Yes, please, go ahead.
Well, just Sparty. You know, I mean, Michigan State is a three seed, as we talked about, maybe a little low. You know, some have them going all the way and winning their national championship. Obviously, they're tournament tested. Tom Izzo does it almost as well as any at this time of the year. Where do you see them? You know, they've got obviously a potential Duke matchup in the Elite Eight, and then of course Kansas is at the top of that region. What do you think about Michigan State?
I only have them getting out to the 16, and I think Duke is going to knock them out. I think that they have a really kind of difficult challenge ahead of them. I think the first weekend's not so bad. I think that TCU, Arizona State, Syracuse, and Bucknell obviously in the first round. Bucknell's a good veteran team, but I just don't like that matchup for them at all. I think that, you know, Michigan State will get to Omaha. But beyond that, I think that Duke is just going to be a little bit too much of a challenge, since they've really kind of gotten things into gear, you know, second loss to North Carolina, you know, accepted. They've kind of gotten things into gear over the last couple of weeks.
Well, you just said it. When they lost to North Carolina, I was going to ask you, have they gotten things into gear? They have been a very inconsistent team for being a top-ranked team, who's supposed to be one of the top two or three in the country at the start of the season. You know, having their seven losses and looking a little bit pedestrian at times, a little less focused maybe than a Coach K's teams normally look, I was, you know, I'm a little bit skeptical about Duke going into this one. I was surprised they had a two seed. I thought they would be a three and Michigan State would be a two.
Yeah, that's a really good point, but the stronger ACC really kind of helped them on that front more than anything else. Mm-hmm. So this is the real curious thing. Duke is just one of many teams this year. It's like you just simply don't know what you're going to get from night to night.
That's true.
You really kind of have to just kind of go with blind faith that they're going to actually make it out that far.
You're right. I mean, I think their talent is enough to make them win this whole thing. It's just that I've seen those inconsistent moments, and you just don't know what you're going to get. Jim, you wanted to ask about upsets. Go ahead.
Yeah, I do, because that's always one of the fun things about the madness part this weekend is what upsets are going to happen. Bob and I, we ran down a wild set that kind of gave the all-time marks of some of these. But I will say, I'm not sure where some of these upsets are going to come from because of the heaviness on major power conference teams, even, you know, your 15-loss Alabama and teams like that. It means I'm looking at all this, and as I was doodling out a few, and like Bob, I reserve the right to not put these in pen until I wake up Thursday morning, But I'm going a lot more chalk on these picks when I've been doodling these out so far since last night than I have before. Give us your top three first-round upset possibilities.
Well, let me put it this way. I'm kind of the same mind because I was doing my draft of my picks post for SB Nation for tomorrow. And in the first round, I only came up with six upsets, and three of those were nines over eights, which really don't at this point.
Yeah, those are 50-50.
So, that's the thing. There were just not a lot of – there are a lot of capable teams, but I just didn't like the matchups they got. Like Murray State getting West Virginia. To me, that was like – that was the one matchup I think is a 5-12 that I didn't really kind of trust them to take. The ones that I'm kind of keeping an eye on
– Hold on a second. Texas I got to erase Nevada. Something real quick. I got to erase something real quick. Hold on, because I had Murray State. You're telling me no. What were your other ones, Chris?
Yeah, Texas over Nevada because Nevada has not played well. They haven't been really as healthy as they were earlier in the season. You know, you look what happened to them when they played, you know, San Diego State in the Mountain West semifinals. So that's one there, even though Texas, you know, kind of stumbled in. Locally for me, Loyola, I think Loyola has Sweet 16 potential. And the other one I think the draw actually favors pretty well is New Mexico State. I think that they can give Clemson a lot of problems, and then I think that Auburn has struggled with injuries as well, and then that's another squad they could potentially get in the round of 32. To me, though, Loyola and New Mexico State are the two that really just kind of jumped out at me as actually getting fairly decent draws.
I thought about New Mexico State, but then I thought the same reason you said a moment ago is just about the ACC. The strength of the ACC is where I kind of give Clemson the edge there, and that makes it hard for me to go 12 over 5 given their battle-testedness, if that's a word, thus far. Hey, we're out of time here. We got to run here, Chris, but just real fast, who wins each region? Give us your final four.
All right, I have one semifinal, Arizona beating Michigan, the other semifinal, Kansas beating Villanova, and then Arizona beating Kansas.
Wow, you've got Michigan going all the way to the Final Four. That is, that would be a thing. And then you said Arizona over Kansas in the championship.
Yeah, the thing with Arizona is they have to get by that Kentucky game, and Kentucky's another one of those teams that I think they have the length and the athleticism to really disrupt Arizona, but they're so inconsistent that if they don't show up for that game, Arizona has a really nice path at that point if they can get past Kentucky.
Chris, is that in pencil or pen for you?
This is going to be in pen. I did Star Talk playing with sports last night and basically gave this, except I switched UNC, Michigan with UNC. So that's the only change I had, but everything else I've stuck with, and that's what's going to go on SB Nation tomorrow.
Very good. Well, we will look for it there. Chris D'Albertine, SB Nation's bracketologist. Chris, thanks so much. Great analysis, great insight. We always appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me once again.
You got it. We appreciate that. Hey, quick question for you before we get to the top of the hour, Sports Center. You need a new roof? $1 down. You need a new siding? It's just $1 down. Or you need some new siding. Need new windows? They're $1 down. Get a new look. Your choice. Roof, siding, windows for $1 down. That's the power of 7 years. Interest free. Do not delay. Call Weather Seal today. Get the roof, the siding, the windows you've always wanted for just $1 down. Call 1-877-WINDOWS. Call Weather Seal today at 877-WINDOWS and get all the details online at weathersealhomeservices.com. We're back after this.
We've been looking at the entire process of selecting. We've talked to a lot of people about the analytics and metrics we use. We're in the process of trying to see if we can generate something new. But I thought the quadrant system certainly gave people outside the room a better picture. I thought it was a better sorting tool. It was really recommended by the national basketball coaches. We feel it gives the public a much better picture of the discussion that goes on in the room. But we're trying to look at how did people do against tournament caliber teams. Who did they play? Where did they play them? How did they do? Oklahoma got in because they played 30-some basketball games. We count each game the same, and they certainly didn't play well down the stretch, but they had an outstanding early part of the season. We look at a game in November to be just as important as we do a game in February and March. They slumped down the stretch. It affected their seeding, but they had enough quality wins in their overall schedule to justify being in the field.
They can do whatever they want now because they've got the veteran quarterback insurance that they needed. They get Tyrod Taylor from the Buffalo Bills. And again, if they want to go Sam Darnold at number one, Josh Allen at number one. They now have a quarterback so that they can play him and not have to rush a rookie along in Cleveland. They can bring him along slowly, and they can bring him along as Tyrod Taylor is throwing to Jarvis Landry, who the Cleveland Browns surrendered two picks for today.
I think it actually solidifies the fact that they will stick with a quarterback. Not probably. I think that they have to. They haven't addressed the position from a position of strength since they came back in 1999 when they took Tim Couch. That's the last time they actually took a quarterback top 10. Now they have the opportunity to decide which one they want, take him first, and he can then wait for a year behind Tyrod Taylor, who's on a one-year contract, and then presumably take over in 2019.
John Dorsey, their new general manager, who's got together, let's face it, some significant personnel staff together, that he has been plotting and planning for some time. These things just don't happen with a snap of the finger. I have no doubt that Tyrod Taylor was kind of a target for him.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
I don't know what was more insane, the announcements of the brackets on Sunday or the Browns' flurry of trading activity over the course of the previous 2 days. Unbelievable moves made by John Dorsey, the new general manager of the Browns, not letting the grass grow under his feet, getting off and running. Now we are in the tampering period of free agency. Free agency can start on Wednesday as the league calendar year begins. And then, of course, we've got the draft, and the Browns are being remade entirely. Joining us now is our good friend Scott Petrak, who covers the Cleveland Browns. He's been a longtime beat writer for the Browns, and he does all of his work online. He writes in a newspaper too, but you just won't be able to get it way out in Toledo. But over there in Cleveland, you can see his work in newspapers for you. You just get it at BrownsZone.com. Great coverage of all things Browns at BrownsZone.com. Scott Petrak, good to have you back. How are you?
I'm good, Bob. How are you?
Good, my friend. Thank you so much for taking the time. Did you see this coming during your, coverage of the team and your covering of press conferences and conversations, scouting combine and all the rest? Did you know that John Dorsey had this big slew of trades he was ready to start pulling the trigger on?
I don't know if I can say that. I knew that he was going to be aggressive. Obviously they're not satisfied with the roster that went 0-16. They needed to get older. They needed to get more experience. They needed quality starters at a bunch of different positions. You knew that they would target quarterback, receiver, and secondary. The fact that he addressed those needs in trades rather than wait until free agency opened this week, I think is a smart move, because no matter how much money you have, it doesn't guarantee these players are going to want to sign in Cleveland and want to sign on a team that went 0-16 last year. By trading for players, whether or not they only have 1 year left on their contract or under the franchise tag like Jarvis Landry is, it guarantees you get them in the building, and that's something you couldn't count on in free agency. So I think it was wise that he struck like he did in trades.
I got to tell you, Scott, I am so glad to hear you say that, because I didn't want to say it. Because I've been very cynical, as you know. Over the last 2 years, I've just been so disgusted with the appointment of Sashi Brown as the guy in charge of the football ops and, the whole let's embrace the computer of Paul DePodesta and all the rest. I just was so down on it. The results obviously proved that I was right. I was down on Hugh Jackson. His results proved that I was right, but yet he's still there. And I didn't want to be the cynical one, but it's reality. I don't think they had confidence that they could throw money at free agents and make them want to come to the laughing stock of the National Football League. So in order to guarantee that they come, you have to trade for them. Now they've got no choice because they're under their contracts, and they've got to come here. So, John Dorsey really kind of, had his finger on the pulse of, how that franchise, how the Browns franchise is viewed by players and agents around the league.
Well, I think you're right, Bob, and I think it's smart. It doesn't mean that they couldn't have gotten A.J. McCarron or Allen Robinson or any of those other big guys that they would have targeted, but it means there was a chance that they wouldn't have. And I don't think the Browns in their state could have afforded to come up, to wake up Friday morning and not have a veteran quarterback to start week one and not have a receiver to join Josh Gordon, and then not have added a piece to their secondary. They just couldn't have done that. And now, not only do they guarantee that they have those pieces, I think it makes the team more attractive to the free agents that they're going to go after in the next 3 days. So to me, it's a win-win. And, in a perfect team, in a perfect world, You know, maybe you don't pay Tyrod Taylor $16 million for one season. But this team can afford it. This team is desperate for a quarterback that doesn't turn the ball over, that has a winning record in this league, and can start while the rookie sits on the bench. And that's worth $16 million. And A.J. McCarron probably would have cost more. And from people I talked to in Cincinnati, they didn't think A.J. wanted to come to a situation where a number one pick was sitting behind him and breathing down his neck the whole time. So I think that's a perfect world. I think Jarvis Landry makes all the sense in the world. And they needed to help the secondary. I don't like the idea of giving up on DeShone Kizer, but I think he wasn't going to get another chance, another good chance to start in Cleveland. So why not give him a fresh start somewhere else?
Totally agree about the Kizer part as well. We're talking to Scott Petrak, Browns beat reporter. Follow his work online at brownszone.com. So let me talk about Taylor. Does this effectively end the A.J. McCarron talk?
Yes. It's over. The only veterans I could see them add are somebody who could be a backup. So you need insurance in case Taylor gets hurt. You don't want, whatever you want, whatever you do, you don't want to force the number one pick to play before you think he's ready. And you don't trust Kevin Hogan or Cody Kessler. So I think a guy like Chase Daniel, who has a history with John Dorsey, isn't a starter, but if you sign him as a backup, that's fine. You know, maybe Josh McCown, if he doesn't have a market where a team thinks he can start, you know, he's the perfect mentor. He could play if you need him to play. I think those two guys could be signees down the road. But A.J. McCarron, Case Keenum, I don't think there's any way they add those guys.
So let's talk about Taylor and what you expect from him. Is it just exactly what we just heard in the opening montage there, the opinion of Patrick McManaman and others that said basically it's just the 1 year, it's a 1 year deal, and they will use this year to groom whoever is that number one pick? And do you think now, also Scott, it's kind of a double question, or two part question, I guess I should say, that this makes it more likely that Baker Mayfield might be their guy because, you know, Darnold is considered to be more polished perhaps, and maybe Rosen as well, to come in right away and start for somebody. But if they're gonna definitely sit their first pick, their number one quarterback that they take for a year, that it might be a little more, you know, a guy needs a little more seasoning. Or maybe it's Josh Allen for the same exact reason, sure, that Taylor will start, and that it kind of gives us a hint as to who they're leaning toward as a quarterback in the draft.
Yeah, to answer the first part of the question, I do agree with Pat that it's a one-year, he's your bridge quarterback. I think you still have to take a quarterback at number one. Now, there's people in the league who probably feel Tyrod Taylor can be a franchise quarterback. He's only 28. But, you know, Buffalo decided he wasn't a franchise quarterback, and he wasn't their long-term answer. You know, they had a chance to keep him last year, and they were ready to get rid of him and then restructured his deal. They could have kept him this year and decided he wasn't worth it. You know, they're probably going to trade up in the draft to take somebody to replace him. So, you know, I don't think you can look at Tyrod Taylor and go, okay, he's the answer, which means you draft a guy number one. That doesn't mean they can't restructure the contract, maybe add a couple years, and he becomes your number two. If the number one pick becomes ready. But he's certainly, at least in my eyes, not the long-term answer. When it comes to how it affects the draft, it's interesting because, you know, we don't know John Dorsey that well. You know, you look what he did in Kansas City, talked to him a handful of times, but we don't have a track record from his time here to say, okay, how's he going to, you know, do stuff? You know, what can we look at and say, okay, we know that he's going to take this next step. I think Tyrod Taylor, because of the type of quarterback he is, little bit of a runner, you know, not your prototypical height, suggests, okay, maybe that means you pair him with Baker Mayfield or even Lamar Jackson. And that's the kind of offense you commit to. But I look at it as he was the best veteran you could get, period. And it doesn't change who you're going to take in the draft. You still take the quarterback you think is best at number one, regardless of skill, style of play, size. And I think that's still Sam Darnold. But, you know, it's really still open that John Dorsey could take any of those top four guys at number one, but I'm leaning toward Darnold myself.
Interesting analysis. I was thinking the same thing until you said Lamar Jackson in there. He's not among those considered, right? It is still just those top four guys.
Well, not in the top five, but could they take Saquon Barkley at one, trade from four to 12 and take Lamar Jackson at 12, or make another trade with Buffalo and take Lamar Jackson at 21. You know, I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility. I don't think that's likely to happen. But I'm just saying, when you trade for a guy like Tyrod Taylor, that went through my head. Is, okay, maybe they're deciding that they want to go dual threat. And who are the two best dual threat guys in the draft? You know, Lamar Jackson and Baker. Although, you know, Sam Darnold's an athlete too, so you could run that system with him. But, you know, I'm just saying, you talk to enough people in the league and they're intrigued by Lamar Jackson, not as a top five pick, but as a guy that could have a big time future in this league. I'm just not sure how intrigued the Browns are.
Scott, how will Tyrod Taylor take to the situation, knowing that he's just a one-year bridge quarterback? He didn't take very well when they benched him in Buffalo for I don't know, somebody, Jim Cushlin. I guess his name is Nathan Peterman. Yeah. But you understand the point. He did not take very well to it. Yeah. He was a little public with his vocal dissent. A lot of people agreed, by the way, with him that it never should have happened, and it probably shouldn't have. But he's not a guy that, you know, I think wants to be jerked around from at least that recent history. Do you think he will be able to lead this team in the huddle if he believes, you know what, I'm a short-timer. I'm not here. You know, I got Darnold sitting behind me, the number one overall pick in the draft. I'm only here for 16 weeks, and whatever happens, happens. Can you lead a team, a young team, by the way, with all the draft picks they're about to have? You know, can you lead a team like that with a veteran who knows he's not here, you know, for the big picture?
Well, I think you can if you're the right guy. You know, we saw John Kitna do it. You know, this is, whatever, 15 years ago. You know, he played knowing Carson Palmer was going to take his spot the next year, and I think he went 8-8, and everybody loves John Kitna in Cincinnati. And from what I hear out of people in Buffalo, they love Tyrod Taylor. You can talk about how frustrated he was when he got benched. He came back in and led him to the playoffs, you know, for the first time in 18 years. So he was able to handle it. He knew he was on a short leash to start the season because of the contract restructuring. So I think he'll handle it fine. And the fact is, if he plays great, you know, if he wins nine games, I'm just throwing this out there. If he wins nine games, goes from 0-16 to 9-7 because he's your quarterback, then nobody says, there's no law that says you got to go with the rookie the next year. And even if he did, Tyrod Taylor is going to go make some money somewhere else. So, you know, he'll be as motivated as ever to prove that he should be the starter, to prove that he shouldn't be replaced in 2000, let alone, you know, at the midway point of 2018. And from everything I hear, I think he's got the right makeup to handle it.
That's really interesting to hear, and that's a good point. You know, he does have his, you know, his own future to play for. And if, by the way, if he wins nine games, not only is he going to make a lot of money, he's going to get a statue probably. I mean, if you go from 1-15 to 0-16 to 9-7 with this guy, he would be a folk hero, for crying out loud, in Cleveland. Let's talk about some of the other gets. Jarvis Landry. You know, I look at Landry's statistics, and you say, wow. Very productive guy, can get the ball into the end zone, has had some really, really eye-popping numbers, couple of thousand-plus yard reception years and so on. But he's done it in an offense that has a tradition, not that, you know, it was Drew Brees, but he had a quarterback who can get him the ball, and a downfield threat, a guy who can go out there and make it happen. Is he that valuable in an offense like this one, where I don't know how much of a downfield passer Tyrod Taylor is versus more of an underneath, you know, game-managing, protective, run the ball and use your feet as much as you do anything else kind of a thing? In other words, will he be as valuable in Cleveland as his statistics indicate he has been, for example, in Miami?
Yeah, that's a fair question, but I will say this, Bob. He plays mostly out of the slot, and, you know, some people argue that $16 million, which is a franchise tag, is too much to pay a slot receiver. And I would counter with, that's probably true, except the Browns need anybody at receiver. And they didn't have a slot receiver. And Corey Coleman has done nothing to make you think that he's going to be, you know, a legitimate threat in this league. Josh Gordon is anything but a sure thing from his history. So now you got a guy that you know can catch the ball, you know is physical after he has the ball in his hands. Reliable. 400 catches is the most by far for any receiver in his first 4 years in the league. And, you know, he doesn't have a great yards per catch. I think it's about 10. I think it was under 10 last year. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he catches underneath stuff. And that's what Tyrod Taylor does best. Not to say he can't go downfield, because he can. But But I think he can do it all. He just does it all from the slot. And if you put Josh Gordon on one side and he stays healthy or stays clean, and you put either Corey Coleman or you go get a guy like Terrell Pryor on the other side outside, I think all of a sudden you got some options for Tyrod Taylor and for Hugh Jackson and for Todd Haley.
We'll talk about Terrell Pryor and other potential targets in free agency after asking about the third player acquired in the trades. And you know, when you look at Demarius Randall, you think, okay, wow, you know, they needed to shore up the cornerback position, no doubt about it. But then the first thing you look at and you hear coming out of Berea is that he's probably not going to play corner for the Browns. He's probably going to be a free safety, allowing them to move Jabril Peppers up to strong safety, which is by far a much more natural position for him. So how much does this help the secondary?
Well, it helps because they needed a free safety, right? I mean, you mentioned Peppers, and he was moving to strong safety regardless. So they're going to have add a free safety. I think this gives them more position flexibility. Let's say they don't sign one of these top corners in free agency, the, you know, Trumaine Johnson or the Malcolm Butler, and they wind up finding a safety they like. Then you can play Randall at corner. He was good enough at corner with Green Bay. He had a pretty good game against Josh Gordon in December at corner. That's all he's played in the NFL. So I think he gives you position flexibility, just like if you drafted a guy like Micah Fitzpatrick, would give you that flexibility to kind of finagle how you want to play the secondary. But Alonzo Highsmith and Elliott Wolf, new members of the front office, were in Green Bay when they drafted Randall. So they know all about him. They scouted him as a safety at Arizona State. So there's a comfort level there with him. And I think when you look at it, let's slot him in at free safety, which they're going to do for now. So you got free safety, you got Jabril Peppers, a strong safety, and then you got question marks at corner. So they need to go address that and decide, you know, can Jamar Taylor still play? Can Jason McCourty still play? Or do we need to go get two new starting corners? And you could see them do that starting in free agency and then adding a guy like Micah Fitzpatrick or Denzel Ward early in the draft.
Do you think they'll put Randall's locker next to Josh Gordon's?
I don't think so, but I'll tell you what, that's the thing. You know, and I mentioned those guys on a comfort level with him. You know, you read up about him in Green Bay, and he has some issues. He has a sideline meltdown with a coach.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some players reportedly asked the management to release him because they didn't like him on the team, and then he got his act together, played better during the middle and end of the season. But there were some issues. I don't know, you know, I don't know him well enough to say maturity issues or what the deal is. He got in a social media fight with Josh Gordon. So I think if you look at it, you go, whoa, who are they adding? But then, I like I said, I think there is a comfort level knowing that Elliott Wolf and Alonzo Highsmith did a lot of research on this guy only 3 years ago and felt comfortable enough to draft him at the end of the first round. So it's okay taking a chance on adding him.
Yeah, and Josh Gordon, by the way, I thought it was interesting, and I couldn't quite tell if it was tongue-in-cheek or not when he actually tweeted good when the announcement of Randall's acquisition was made. Now he can bust, I'm paraphrasing, bust your chops or bust your you-know-whats at practice every day. So he's, you know, apparently in a good-natured way, it would sound like saying, welcome aboard, let's be on the same side now.
Yeah, and these guys go back and forth so much, you know, in social media, on the field, that, you know, maybe we make too much of a big deal out of it. You know, it's not real bad blood, it's just trash talk, and when they get together, they're fine.
Scott, why did Danny Shelton have to go to the Patriots?
Well, I don't know if he had to go. The reason he went, he wasn't a perfect fit for Greg Williams' 4-3. You know, he likes his tackles to attack. He wants the tackles to be able to rush the passer. And Danny's too big for that. Danny's a two-gap, run-stuffing nose tackle at 335 or 40 or 50 pounds, whatever he is. And that's not how Greg's defense is. Now, I thought Danny played fine last year, making the adjustment from nose tackle to D tackle, but he's not on the field that much. I think it was about 40% of the snaps. They had to make a decision on picking up his fifth-year option, which would have been a bunch of money, and guaranteed if he got hurt. You know, so I think they decided it was the right time to move on. You can make the argument they could have waited. They didn't have to make that fifth-year decision until May, but maybe the Patriots fill that void in free agency, and then all of a sudden you don't get that third-round pick back in 2019. So, you know, Danny's a good guy. I thought he played hard. I think the losing bothered him a bunch, and that won't be an issue in New England, obviously. You know, would I like to see the Browns get more? Yeah, but that's probably not realistic in today's day and age where teams give up on, you know, first-round picks after 3 years.
We are talking with Scott Petrak, Browns beat reporter. Follow his work at BrownsZone.com, BrownsZone.com. So going back to the quarterback just real quick, you mentioned something in passing in one of your previous answers about maybe Saquon Barkley being the number one overall pick. I can't picture John Dorsey picking even somebody as highly touted as Barkley number one. You know, because if you really look at it, even though they have Tyrod Taylor now, and maybe perhaps they can get the second of their choices of quarterbacks at four, you know, assuming that their first choice would be taken at two or three, so they can go ahead and grab Barkley. I just don't know that Dorsey puts that kind of value on running backs, does he? I mean, he found Kareem Hunt in the third round, a Toledo product, Kareem Hunt, who led the NFL in the third round. Would he throw the first pick at a running back?
I don't think he would, Bob, and I think it would be ridiculous to do that. I'm completely against taking a running back at number one. I'm not even sure. I don't even like it in the top five. I just think you can find similar value later in the draft. I don't think Saquon Barkley is a generational guy. I like him. Like him as a guy. Like him as a player. Think he's good. Think he's the best running back in the draft. He doesn't scream Jim Brown at me. He doesn't even scream Adrian Peterson at me. Having said that, the only reason I mention it is because you keep hearing so much buzz about it. So somebody's talking about it being a possibility. I don't know if that's a smokescreen. I don't know if that's a enthralled with him at the combine, and then you come back to reality and take your quarterback. I just don't want to dismiss it, even though personally I would dismiss it.
Scott, now that they have made these moves, obviously, it may change the focus as far as the positions that they target when free agency begins. Then, of course, depending on how successful they are getting guys to sign on the dotted line of free agency, that impacts the draft. So this is kind of impossible to play all the way out. But without naming names of potential free agents, can you at least get an idea based on now that they have acquired a corner, well, a safety essentially, a wide receiver and a quarterback, what will be their first target come free agency starting on Wednesday in terms of position?
Well, let me give this caveat. If Joe Thomas retires, then I think left tackle becomes number one priority. And Nate Solder from New England would be the top target. And after that, I think it's not a great free agent class, but it's also not a great draft class. If Joe Thomas comes back, I think you still need cornerback, number one, receiver. And then I would turn to adding some veterans to help young position groups. Pass rusher, you can help out Myles Garrett and Emmanuel Ogba by adding a third guy and kind of be your third down veteran pass rusher. And tight end, because they got young guys in Seth DeValve and David Njoku. I'd like to see an experienced guy come in and help that group.
And then if you talk about Joe Thomas, I kind of feel like, and I'm maybe completely wrong, but he has been saying for a little while now that he will make his decision very soon about whether he's going to come back one more time. And part of me wondered if John Dorsey didn't pull the trigger on all of these trades when he did to increase the chances that Joe comes back. Look, Joe, we're not going to sit here. We're not going to just trade for more picks. We're going to get players who can make us better right now. Stick around. This is going to be different than what you've seen in the past. Do you think that these trades and this aggressive approach by Dorsey makes it more likely that Joe says, okay, I do want to be a part of this and make one more run at having a winner?
Well, I know that Joe and John Dorsey have talked multiple times since John got here in December and through the offseason. Joe, every time I've talked to him, has said, whatever the Browns do won't matter. It comes down to how he thinks his knees and back will hold up. Having said that, I know how much he likes Tyrod Taylor, and I think it can't hurt for John Dorsey to have made those moves. And if Joe is on the fence, which he said he is, he keeps going back and forth whether to retire or return, how does this not help nudge him toward return?
Yeah, that's kind of my thing. I mean, you know, he's been so gracious about playing his entire Hall of Fame career on such a terrible team with no chances at the playoffs virtually ever. And you know, he doesn't want to go out that way. I kind of feel like he really wants to see some steps being made that show, you know what, we can push. We might not go worst to first all the way to the Super Bowl, but doggone it, we can push. And if we increase this team improve this team's roster with veterans who have won in this league, like some of these guys we're talking about are in Taylor and Landry and Randall, and we can do a little bit more of that in free agency, that he will give it one more shot so we can go out and, as you said earlier, you know, if he goes out on a 9-7 after everything he's been through, that will probably feel like a Super Bowl to him.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I mean, Derek Anderson had that one big year. Joe was a rookie. Yeah, but he's never played with a quarterback as good as Tyrod Taylor. I'm not putting Tyrod Taylor in the Hall of Fame. It's just fact. He hasn't played with a quarterback that good. So I'm sure that's somewhat enticing to him. You know, and he's also probably weighing whatever that TV option is. You know, if Fox or ESPN offers him $7 million and you don't have to get hit ever, you know, maybe that makes up for the $3 million he'd be giving away. So he's weighing a lot of stuff, but it can't hurt that John Dorsey was aggressive as he was on Friday.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. I think that's a great point. You know, the TV money might be huge for him, and there's a lot of guys who give up their coaching or their playing careers just to go and grab that as soon as they can. But I think that money will be there if he sticks around one more year, and I really think he would like to go out on a on an up note rather than the, you know, the starting left tackle for 1-31 in his last 2 years. I don't think he wants to end it that way, but that's just me.
It's Scott. And the injury, too. And he's coming up, he's coming up the injury, too, you know?
Right. No question. Yeah, I think he'd like to come back from that and show exactly, you know, what he's still got left, at least one more time. Scott, awesome work on BrownsZone.com. Can't tell people enough. Please bookmark that on your browser. Make sure it's a favorite on your smartphone, however it is that you view the Internet, because that's where you're going to get great comprehensive Browns news and analysis and commentary. Scott Petrak, thank you, my friend. Keep up the great work. We'll talk soon.
Appreciate it, Bobby.
You got it. All right, there's Scott Petrak talking a little Browns. We had a lot of ground to cover with them because they made a ton of moves, and they've obviously got a lot more in front of them. Coming up, we go back to the NCAAs. Why? Well, because we now know where the Buckeyes are going to be. But Buckeyes have been very quiet. Nobody's talking about them for the last week, and that's because they lost early in the Big Ten Conference Tournament. And the Big Ten Conference Tournament itself was so early last week. People have been kind of sleeping on the Buckeyes, as they will have almost two full weeks before they play in between games. But the seedings are out, and we're going to talk to Paul Keels, the voice of the Ohio State Buckeyes, when we come back about their tournament chances as we continue right here on ESPN 106.
Now, back to Bob France, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Rolling along we are. It's 4:44. Thanks for joining us right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo Sports Leader. Great conversation with Scott Petrak. A lot of news out of Cleveland with the Browns there. Good stuff earlier on as well with Chris D'Albertine doing some bracketology with us, SB Nation style. And now it's time to talk to the voice, once again, of Ohio State basketball and football and many more on the Ohio State Radio Network. Mr. Paul Keels joining us on The Ticket. Hey, Paul, how are you? Good to have you back.
I'm good, Bob. How you doing?
We are outstanding. Thank you. Appreciate the chance to talk a little bit of tournament basketball with you. And, you know, I just mentioned going into the break before you came on, Paul, nobody's talked about Ohio State, it seems like, in weeks. And the reason why, of course, is, you know, the Big Ten tournament was a week earlier than normal, and they went out in it very early. And so they've kind of just been almost an afterthought for a lot of people as we watched, you know, Michigan rise up and win that tournament. And they and Sparty both get three seeds. Purdue gets a two seed. And then there's Ohio State. Oh, yeah, forgot about those guys. They check in with a five seed, and they're going to play South Dakota out in the West. What is your thought on the Buckeyes now as far as, you know, how they'll respond after a lengthy layoff and the matchup against South Dakota?
Well, I think, Bob, the thing we saw that the week with no games didn't really affect any of the Big Ten teams as regard to seeding. It was a distinct possibility, and Chris Holtman even admitted he thought that they might follow a six seed, having gone out the first game they played in New York and having not played for a week. But, and I think where the other schools that you mentioned finished, I think that certainly showed that they probably were where we all thought they were going to be when the Big Ten tournament ended. But, you know, from Ohio State standpoint, and Chris Holtman echoed it.
Paul, before you go on to Ohio State, does that surprise you that there were really no changes based on that?
No, not really. No, and I don't know as far as the two bubble teams that didn't make it. I don't know that it affected them one way or the other. But no, I don't think so. I think maybe if there had been a different scenario that had played out, or some different things, or even more chaos in some of the other conferences, maybe it would have been a little different. The good news is, at least in most of our working lifetime, we're not going to see that happen again. Jim Delaney has admitted, the Big Ten commissioner, the compressed schedule is something they don't want to revisit. Which is good to hear. I think that they do want to revisit it sometime going back east with a tournament. That is not a good thing, at least in my opinion and a lot of others. But not terribly surprised, I guess.
Okay, now let's talk about the Buckeyes and where they are. You know, after this layoff, obviously everybody has a long layoff in the Big Ten tournament because of when they played that thing. But Ohio State maybe a little bit more than others. And as I said, they head out west and they draw South Dakota. What's your initial take on the matchup?
Well, I know that, that Chris Holtman mentioned at their get-together last night to watch the selection show. They didn't care where they were going or who they were going to play. They were just glad to be in it, especially after 2 years of not being in it. So, you know, I think that this is a team that probably needs to start seeing different competition. What we saw at the end of the regular season was some of the difficulty they ran into playing Big Ten teams that they were playing for a second, and in one case a third time, that are a little more familiar with them. So I think it's going to be good to see opponents that aren't in the same conference, that aren't as familiar, a different, you know, different types of matchups, different scenery, if you will. So, you know, and you know, the thing I guess we really won't know until the games start occurring what this layoff did. But, you know, what Chris Holtman and Ohio State tried to do is make a combination of rest, practice, conditioning, and recruiting.
Paul, if we go ahead and assume that the seeding holds true and that the Buckeyes take care of business against South Dakota, a second-round matchup in that first weekend to get to 16 would involve probably Gonzaga, again, holding, assuming that the seeding holds true. And we all know what happened. You know, they're two different teams now because we're talking, what, fourth, fifth, sixth game of the season, somewhere along that line, somewhere along those lines, that they face Gonzaga. And got rolled by 30-plus, I believe it was, or somewhere close to that, or almost 30. Again, acknowledging that they're different teams, and Ohio State did some really, really special things and improved as the season went on, how would you view that potential matchup over the weekend?
Well, again, the Gonzaga game was one of the ones I didn't do because it was the night before the Michigan football game in Ann Arbor.
That's right.
But you say Ohio State is a different team. I think Gonzaga is a different team also, Bob. You know, they were replacing a lot of firepower from the team that went to the national championship game last year. So I think they're a better basketball team also. And if that plays out, it's in essence going to be a home game for Gonzaga. They're so much closer to Boise than anybody else out there. So, you know, that figures to be a really big matchup for Ohio State to handle. But I think this is an Ohio State team that has shown they're a little more confident in those situations than they were back in November when they played Gonzaga. And, you know, so that'll be interesting. But I think also, as you can imagine, the coach speak has come out, Chris Holtman and his staff, not assuming anything. They, you know, South Dakota State has a guy that many people think might get a chance to play in the NBA. They're one of the top 10 teams in the country when it comes to three-point shooting. They average almost 85 points a game. So, you know, there's always those upsets that people want to pick. And, you know, South Dakota State certainly is one of those that probably a few folks are putting their hard-earned shekels down on. But, yeah, but if it is a rematch with Gonzaga, yes, Ohio State's a different team, but Gonzaga is, in a lot of cases, a better team also now.
Paul, how do you look back at this season if that upset were to happen? You know, I mean, because you're right. You said the Buckeyes didn't care where they were seated. Chris Holtman said we're just going to watch it. Wherever we are, we're going to be happy. We're in the tournament. We have not been the last couple. But if it's a one-and-done, you get in there and you lose in an upset to a South Dakota State, do you remember this season for the accomplishments and the player of the year and the coach of the year and the, you know, leading the Big Ten very late in the season before a little bit of a stumble late? Or do you think about the disappointment of, man, one and done and we lost to, you know, a 12 seed?
I think it's both of those things, Bob. It would be a disappointment of going out, but also time would help everybody kind of focus on this as a season that, you know, realistically, none of us expected this to be a team that we'd be talking about that would be in the NCAA tournament and the last 2 weeks of the season would be playing for a chance at a Big Ten championship. You know, that far exceeded what anybody thought, save maybe those guys in that locker room and on that coaching staff. So, you know, a first win, you know, we've lived the life of first round losses before with Ohio State to Dayton, to Siena in double overtime, to Utah State. You know, those really are upsetting when as a higher seed you end up dropping a basketball game. But this team has accomplished so much. I think that most people are looking at this. Yes, it's bonus and it's gravy that they're in the NCAA tournament. But now that you're there, you want to stay for as long as you can.
Yeah, no question about it. And, Paul, let's look at the tournament as a whole, if we could. Well, actually, just the Big Ten teams that, as we mentioned, Purdue at 2 and Michigan and Michigan State both 3s. You pretty happy with that? I mean, a lot of people have said, and we've talked about it being a quote-unquote down year for the Big Ten somewhat. That's 3 teams rated among the top 12, if you look at it that way, with, you know, the top 4 seeds in, or the top 3 seeds in four different regions. That's 4 teams in the top 12 in the country. That's not bad.
No, not at all. I think certainly Michigan State and Purdue were teams that earlier in the year we thought could be playing for a number one seed. You know, had Michigan State won the Big Ten tournament to go along with the regular season championship, maybe they would have gotten consideration for that. you know, if Purdue hadn't run into some of the things that they ran into late in the season, maybe they would have been looking at a higher position. I think for those schools, really, what is advantageous to them is they're playing close to home. Michigan State playing in Detroit, Purdue playing in Detroit. So I think that works to their advantage. You know, Michigan will be the interesting one to watch because by a lot of counts, you probably could have seeded them higher the way they're playing. But, you know, and they're going to be the one I think a lot of people think Michigan might be that team with the role that they're on. They could put together another real good run in the postseason with the way John Beilein's offense and the way they play defense, how it makes things difficult for people.
Well, you know, our guest we had on before, a bracketologist from SB Nation, actually picked them to go to the Final Four. And I know Jay Billis, among others, has said Michigan State is going to win the whole doggone thing. So a lot of respect there for the Big Ten. Among those teams, who do you think Michigan, because you kind of alluded to it a moment ago, do you think they have the best chance to, you know, making a run all the way to the Final Four?
I don't know if I'd say they have the best chance. I would agree Michigan State because of a number of things, but mostly because of their guard play. When you think about the way Cassius Winston has played in the last month of the season, the intangibles that Tum-Tum Naren brings to them in the backcourt, the game-changing type of player that Miles Bridges can be, Jaren Jackson, all the different things he can do. And you know, Tom Izzo has said when things have been tough for them, it's because they've shown their youth. They're not as young as they were. So I think they've got a lot of the tools. I think Purdue's got an opportunity also to make a deep run because of, you know, the load that Isaac Haas is. And if Carson Edwards plays the way he did in the back half of the season, it would not be surprising if Purdue makes a run to the Final Four either. So I think, you know, those are three teams out of the Big Ten that have got the makings possibly to really go very deep in this tournament.
Virginia, the number one team, overall number one seed in the tournament. They have been spectacular, although a lot of people would say boring. They play the game in a very different way, a slowdown game rather than an up-and-down-the-court game. They play great defense, and they just win. Are they the odds-on favorite to win the national championship for Paul Keels?
I would think so. And, you know, I think everybody would love to be bored with all of the wins that they have. And, you know, had a chance to watch pretty much most of their game the other night against North Carolina. And while they get so much credit and everybody talks, Bob, about how well they play defense, it maybe doesn't give a lot of justice to what they do offensively. They've got the ability at crucial times to really make big plays on offense. They've got enough experience out there. Seemingly nothing rattles them. Every time North Carolina made a push at them the other night, they were ready to push back. You know, I think Virginia has to be looked at as the odds-on favorite.
Paul, have you filled out a bracket yet, or is that still coming this week?
We are discouraged from doing that. The university does not like its people who are associated with it to get involved in those kind of things.
Really? I did not know that. Not even
well, it's kind of an unofficial nudge, but okay. This would be a good one to pick for some upsets that might surprise people.
I think it really would. I think that's very true, and I appreciate you letting me know about that. Then I guess I won't ask you to tell me who you have going to the Final Four. Paul, really great to talk with you. As always, my friend, thank you so much. We look forward to hearing your call on Thursday from the Buckeyes. Is it Thursday or Friday now? I actually don't know.
It's Thursday, guys.
Thursday. It is Thursday. That's right, Thursday.
Thursday afternoon.
Yeah, Thursday afternoon. 3:30. You'll be preempting this show, and I'm sure the fans will be glad to hear you on the call with the Buckeyes in South Dakota. And thank you so much, Paul. We'll check in soon.
You got it, Bob. Take care, guys.
You got it. 4:56 means we're out of time. We got to clear the decks because Mike Miller will not be held back. It is drive time coming your way next. Stay where you are for that. And then we're back tomorrow for the next extravaganza at 3 o'clock. Have yourself a great night. Bye-bye.